Good morning, everyone. We're going to open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have four bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. Because of one of the individuals who would like to be here for the resolution that's not able to get here until close to 9, we're going to start with the second bill in line, which is House Bill 2170. So I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2170. Council.
House Bill 2170 creates a reporting requirement for offenders who move into the state and who work at or attend an institution of higher learning but who are not currently required to register. There's no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Renee Bryant. I'm legislative coordinator for Oregon State Police. I'm here pinch hitting today for the manager of the sex offender registration, Vi Beatty. If she comes walking in the door, I will turn this over to her because I'm sure she has a greater depth of knowledge than I do. This bill is what we think to be a simple clarification of what was intended initially. It brings us into compliance with the Adam Walsh Act, which is a federally legislated act on sex offender registration. And it merely says that if individuals come into the state to attend, teach, practice a vocation, work at an institution of higher education, that they would have to register in the state of Oregon as well. This passed the House unanimously from the Judiciary Committee there. I don't believe there are any nay votes coming from the House, and I'll be happy to answer any questions I'm able to.
Okay. Questions? I guess just for clarification, my understanding is basically we're just trying to close a loophole where we have an individual that can be coming into the state now that would be required under our rules to register, I should say, if they were convicted here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is correct. This is a loophole. These persons do not currently have to register, so this does close that loophole.
All right, thank you. Is there any other individuals who'd like to testify on House Bill 2170? Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close the public hearing on 2170 and open a work session on House Bill 2170.
Mr. Chair, I move 2170 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Wissett, will you be the carrier on this one? So we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2170. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2336.
House Bill 2336 allows for convictions under another jurisdiction's statutory counterpart to be entered into evidence in certain criminal proceedings. Again, no expenditure impact or revenue.
All right. Looks like I have two individuals that are supposed to be here testifying. I've got Gil Myers, and I'm looking for Rob Bovette. And Mr. Bovette's probably not here right now. Is that correct, Elizabeth?
Elizabeth, this is our Chair Brodensky. He's in another hearing right now and is supposed to be out of it any second he's testifying.
Can okay, well we
I
can,
run downstairs and get him?
That's fine. We can take care of this. We're going to close the public hearing at this point. Let me just see. We're going to reopen this, so should I do a recess? Or just, I guess I can close it and reopen it.
I think you just close and reopen the tribute passes.
Yeah, let's just go ahead and close it at this point. And we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on our third House Bill, 2238.
House Bill 2238 increases the penalty for refusing to take a breath test by increasing the period of time a person is ineligible to receive a hardship permit. This had a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you. All right, so we have two individuals who want to give testimony today, Chuck Hayes and Gil Meyer. Why don't you both come up together? And Chuck, we'll let you lead off.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chuck Hayes, and I'm the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Our committee is comprised of individuals that represent treatment, prevention, enforcement, prosecution, the courts, also victims, and also concerned citizens concerned about impaired driving issues. House Bill 2238 is a bill that is requested by the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI to improve the effectiveness of our implied consent law dealing with repeat DUI offenders. Under the proposals of House Bill 2238, a repeat DUI offender who refuses a breath test or a blood test under the Oregon implied consent law will have to wait longer for an hardship permit than if they had actually taken the test and failed the test. The goal of 2238 is to reduce the numbers of repeat offenders who are actually refusing a chemical test under our Oregon implied consent law. The current wait time of 1 year actually, we feel, provides no incentive for a repeat DUI offender to take a breath test or a blood test, because there are the same amount of time involved should that person refuse or take the test and fail. Therefore, many repeat offenders are refusing the test in an effort to try to avoid conviction. By refusing these tests, many of the repeat DUI offenders, their problem of alcohol use goes undetected, along with the seriousness of their drinking driving problem, and also they are able to avoid the needed treatment. Under our current system, we see that repeat offenders are refusing the test, and so therefore they only have this 1 year wait time for a hardship permit. We feel that the issue of repeat DUI offenders needs to be addressed, and this is one of those areas in our current law that we feel is kind of a loophole. And so we are asking that this extension, this time for the wait, the hardship permit for a waiting period be extended to 3 years. As I said earlier, by refusing the test, many of these problem drinking drivers go undetected. So we believe that House Bill 2238 is something that is needed, and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI urges the passage of this measure. We see it as another way that we can send a clear message to repeat DUI offenders that driving under the influence is serious and needs to be taken serious in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Mindy Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I've conferred with several of my colleagues who practice DUII law, and they tell me that session after session, when the legislature increases penalties associated with certain driving conduct, they're aware that their clients, as they come in through the door, are clueless to know that there's been an increased penalty associated with anything. So, for instance, not too long ago, they've made a permanent revocation of a license for your third DUII, but that's not commonly known or understood by the average driver. So if there is to be a deterrent effect here from an increase of a hardship permit, the question we would pose is, what's the means of really transmitting that information to the general public so that they will understand that? With respect to increasing time for hardship permits, there are a lot of unintended consequences that flow from denying anyone a hardship permit. Most practitioners believe that it forces their clients ultimately in a position where they will end up driving, sometimes habitually, hopefully not, but in some instances based on isolated need. And in those instances, then they would be driving uninsured, obviously. We think that there might be a better solution, and we would like to ask the committee to consider some of the laws. Washington has recently enacted a law, and I've got copies here for the committee. They enacted a law that went into effect January 1 of this year, the Ignition Interlock Driver's License. Basically, it's available to anyone who's had their license suspended or revoked or is about to have their license suspended or revoked, and there are certain disqualifiers, but not for failure to refuse a breath test. And so this would essentially require that there be an interlock device on every vehicle
that this driver drives, has access to. And if they have to drive through work, then the employer would have to know that the driver is under this interlock ignition license, but it would not have to be put on necessarily on the work vehicle. But any other vehicle that that driver has access to or does drive would have to have an interlock device. And it has a monthly fine or a monthly fee associated with it. And so they've Washington's created a revolving account for this so that it can finance those who are indigent, and it also can engage in surveillance to see if there's adequate compliance. We just question whether or not increasing a hardship permit doesn't have, again, those unintended consequences of ultimately perhaps in rural areas depriving people of getting to their means of employment. But denying a hardship permit is one of those consequences that doesn't really fall equally on everyone. I mean, if someone does a year in jail, it's going to be the same blue suit and the same sandals and the same food. But if you deprive someone of the opportunity to drive, that doesn't really affect everyone the same. If you were to live in Northwest Portland, you'd be able to get to the grocery store and you'd be able to get to work. If you live in a rural community, you would not. So we think that there might be a smarter way to do it rather than a harder way to do it. And I would like to, at this point, make the copy of the Washington statute available to the committee.
Thank you. Presentation. I'm going to open up for questions, and Senator Boquist first.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just clarification from either counsel or either one of the witnesses here. The staff manager simply says a license suspension under ORS 113.410, and I was just wondering, is that something other than DUI? But I'm kind of looking, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm looking
DUI.
At this. It is DUI, right? It's just another version of saying DUI, right?
Yeah, 813 section okay. Deals with DUI.
So really it's limited to DUIs.
Right. Chuck, I want to get clarification as well. My understanding, the way this would work is if a person has refused to perform the test one time, the second time, you'd have that enhanced penalty.
Second penalty.
And is that based on, would that include individuals who have gone through a diversion and then they're up on the second time, they've refused on the second time, or is this based on a conviction?
Mr. Chair, the way I understand this, this would be the second time. So if a person has gone through diversion, then this would be their second arrest. And so this is under implied consent. And so under implied consent, that would be...
All right, so
by consent.
And did you give testimony on the House side?
Yes, sir, I did.
And was there testimony, based on your testimony, was there any discussion as to whether or not an individual who went through diversion may not fully appreciate and understand the ramifications, because that's pretty much a straightforward process of getting into it. We do in the state allow an individual that one bite of the apple, and I'm wondering if there was any discussion as to whether there'd be, let's say, call it sufficient knowledge, knowing that on a second incident where there wasn't a conviction, that the person would appreciate the that enhanced, call it, penalty.
Mr. Chair, there was some discussion about that and a little bit about diversion, but again, it kind of came back to that we feel that this, we know that that person has had one bite of the apple, but it's also to prevent
people from reoffending, and when they reoffend, understanding that, okay, if I do refuse this breath test, then there will be this an additional waiting time. So
that was pretty much the discussion on the House.
All right. Now, with the on the refusal, the way this, and Chuck, correct me if I'm wrong, when an officer is actually placing someone through this process, on the back of the implied consent form is the language that states what the potential ramifications are. And what I, if I remember correctly, it doesn't state specifically as to telling this person for them in the, as an individual what type of sanction they could be faced with, as compared to just a general statement that you could be facing an enhanced suspension period. Is that what your memory is from being in the field?
Mr. Chair, I've been retired for a little over 5 years, but I believe the form still, the officer is provided with a printout, and so the printout actually tells the officer what this person would be eligible for under whatever situation. So if it was a repeat offense and they'd had one diversion, and so now under implied consent, it would actually tell that officer. So then the officer does read the form, and the form does actually include also the hardship information. So the officer would look at this particular person, the suspect's printout, and know that I am dealing with somebody that would be an enhanced penalty for the refusal, and so therefore would read that to that person, and that person would be made aware of it at the time of the request for the blood or breath.
All right. That's not how I remember officers are doing it in the field. They read the A through L or whatever the stuff is. Mm-hmm. And so I want some clarification as to whether or not at the time that they are informing them that they know that this would be the enhanced penalty or not. Because if it's not, then either we need to make certain that that does occur at that time so that at least they are aware at the time that they are being asked to take the test that they are going to be at that enhanced penalty.
Would it be helpful if I got a copy of the implied consent that they read?
Yeah, we can get a copy of the implied consent, and then I think there's the more important part is at what stage does the officer get the information as to this particular subject as to whether or not they're going to be enhanced or not. Because I believe most of my officers are just reading through the forms, and then they're processing it as to what the length of the probation our suspension period is. So if the implied consent rules require that, I'm going to be a lot more comfortable with knowing that's stated to them before they're asked to take the test as compared to being asked to take the test, having the refusal, and then saying, oh, by the way, you are enhanced, so this is what's happening to you. Senator Boquist.
Good question, Chair, and you may know. I mean, do we have some sort of interlock or blow-in system now in Oregon?
We do. Okay. We do. And we can talk about that as well. There's actually some opportunities or some other bills that have been suggesting maybe some enhanced programs around the interlock.
Yeah, that seems a smart way to get drunk drivers off the road.
Okay. So counsel is just giving me her perspective from her practice that she feels that maybe the officer will know that at the time that they're dealing with them out in the field prior to them getting to the station where they run the request for the breath test. But I'd like to have some clarification on that before we move this and see if there's other suggestions that we may have from committee members as to maybe some other alternatives as well.
And I can provide that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question for you or counsel or for the witnesses. Is there any discretion at all under this? If this happens, they absolutely may not have a hardship permit for 3 years.
No discretion.
Yeah, there is no discretion. And basically what it says is that if it's a three-year enhancement, they would not be able to get a hardship for 1 year. There's a and if it's a 90-day suspension, it's a 30-day without license, and then you can apply for your hardship. And I'm assuming we wouldn't be changing anything else, so there would be a period of time where they would be prohibited on an enhancement of 1 year prior to being eligible for filing for a hardship.
That's correct.
Any other questions or thoughts?
I just have one question.
Yes.
Senator Brzezinski, on the refusal to take a breath test, does this mean in the field? Does this mean at the station? Does this mean if counsel is requested before a breath test is taken, before that? I mean, at what point in time does a refusal constitute a refusal?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsett, it's a refusal that takes place back at the jail or wherever the breath test facility is. And so there's nothing done in the field as far as obtaining a breath test in Oregon. So it would be after the arrest and after implied consent is read to the individual, then the officer requests this person to provide a breath test with the option of also providing blood. And so this is a post-arrest request.
Yeah, and just for clarification, basically the individual is brought to the station or to the jail where there is the machine. The officer is required to actually go through a step-by-step process and start the machine, have it all ready, and at the point when the machine is ready to take the breath test or take the breath sample, they have to ask them at that point, will they take it? And they've already gone through reading this A through L, whatever the number of provisions on the back of it. And at that point, will you take the test? And they say yes or no. And if they say no, of course, it's a refusal. If they hesitate, and the officer will give them some period of time, and then if they stay silent, they just basically say, we take that as a refusal, and then they push the machine and it activates and runs through the process showing that no breath was taken, so there's no sample to be put through an analysis, and that all prints out onto the 5,000 or 8,000.
8,000.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I knew that. Those are the days. So, anyway.
And is the accused allowed to request counsel before they're tested?
They are given the opportunity to have contact with someone by phone. Usually they don't wait until someone actually can show up. And the officer, if it's done appropriately, properly, will give that individual privacy to have that discussion. They will give them a reasonable amount of time, which is dictated through really the courts, but say 15, 20 minutes, something like that, before they will then go to the next step.
Okay.
And I think the other thing that's important, this was interesting, I saw this on the news last night, where there's been an allegation where individuals have been arrested for DUI where they apparently were not showing any alcohol in their system. And the reporter basically made a comment that the person had been taken to the station and then given a breath test, and it came out 00, and they were still were cited. Well, the reality is they are cited, they are arrested out in the field. They are not, they don't basically give you a trip down to the jail or to the police station and then make a determination after the test whether or not you're under the influence. The officer, trooper, deputy, whoever is doing this has to make a decision out in the field based on what they have seen and they have observed, and this is basically just a secondary to the arrest. So I just want to get that on the record so people don't realize that just because the test may come up below a 0.08, that doesn't mean that the person's one's not under the influence and they've already been charged with driving under the influence.
And was that in connection with the expungement issue?
Yes. Yes. And we do have bills that are looking at that. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Chairman, I'd have some of my practitioners respond to your questions as well. I mean, we just wanted something in writing.
Absolutely.
From them. Yeah?
That'd
okay.
be fine.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is there anyone else who want to give testimony today on 2238? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2238. And let's see. I know Ben's here. I saw Kate earlier. I don't know if Kate was going to be here for this or not. I'll go ahead and open up the the public hearing on our first bill, since we now have the treasurer here, on House Bill HCR3. And we're going to change out counsel for a moment. And so, Ben, I believe you're going to be testifying if you want to come forward. And I did see Secretary of State Kate Brown in the room earlier. I don't know if she was planning on testifying on this, but if she is, maybe someone can see her and they can get her to come back up. So, counsel, why don't you tell us what we've got?
House Concurrent Resolution 3. Memorializes the life of Brian Johnston, who lived from 1949 to 2008. It expresses the state's deep appreciation for his outstanding service to Oregon and delineates his many professional and personal accomplishments. As background, Brian Johnston moved to Oregon in 1978 with the belief in the importance of serving his community through public service. From 1995 to 1999, he served in the Oregon House of Representatives. As a public defender with a background in dispute resolution, Johnston was known for his problem-solving skills, dynamic speeches, and the ability to bring people together. Although his main focus was negotiation and teaching, he always found time to serve Oregon in various capacities. He worked as interim president of Willamette University, interim director of United Way of the Mid-Willamette Valley, interim director of the State Department of Human Services, and served on countless committees and boards, to name a few. Brian Johnston's legacy as a public servant will outlive him as a model for all Oregonians.
right, thank you.
And just for the record, for those who don't know, our special counsel today is Courtney Johnson, daughter of Brian. So, Mr. Treasurer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, a very heartfelt thank you for bringing this bill forward and allowing his hearing. I think this is an important activity, an important action by this committee and hopefully the entire body. So first of all, thank you for your efforts. And Courtney, it is my pleasure to meet you. I had the privilege of working with Brian Johnston as a legislator and later in his capacity as interim director of DHS. I know many of you on this committee and in this hearing room have the same privilege. Brian Johnston understood people. And at this time of pride and grief, it is still difficult to express our Oregon and certainly his family's loss. He was an incredibly talented, skilled mediator, a deft administrator. Really, when there's a difficult issue, challenge, or problem, it wasn't just that Brian Johnston was called in. He was the first one anyone thought of. He held that respect and admiration of his skills and capacity. You know, in simplest words, he made this a better place. Not by championing, self-indulgent causes or grandstanding. It was simply skill. It was simply his capacity as a human being to relate to other human beings. It was a gift, and he shared it with us generously and wisely. I first met him when I was a member of the House of Representatives in 1997, my first term. Always a collaborator, always a coalition builder, but most importantly, a human being trying to help other human beings. The issue before us isn't that he's gone, which we certainly all, share the loss, the pain, the lack of camaraderie, friendship, father, husband. The issue before us is what he has left behind. And it really comes down to the words of Sir Isaac Newton. Once said, if I can see further, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants. Brian Johnston was that giant. And we as a people, culture, community, we all see further because of his noble, true efforts to make not just Oregon a better place, but us as people, better human beings. Mr. Chair, again, I very much thank you for your efforts, your recognition, and it is my pleasure to meet especially you, his daughter. Thank you, sir.
Ben, thank you very much. Any questions for the Treasurer? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Secretary is upstate, as I was going to say. I was going to say Kate, but that wasn't going to be right, Secretary or Kate. So, Kate, I know you're here. I don't know if you wanted to testify. I heard that maybe you were just here to listen to the testimony.
I'm happy to testify if the committee wishes or not.
It's up to you. And Tobias, I assume that you would like to come on up. And Drew, I didn't know if you wanted to participate.
Good morning, committee members. For the record, Kate Brown, your current Secretary of State. I am both delighted and very sad to be here this morning to testify in support of HCR3, a memorial to one of our former colleagues, Representative Brian Johnston. I am, for the committee's information, I'm part of a group of folks that is creating the Brian Johnston Award, and we are going to be having a mediation conference in his honor at Willamette University on April 4th, and would sure love it if any of you would join us on that day. It should be a really special conference and a really special opportunity. I think there are a number of reasons why the Oregon legislature ought to honor Brian Johnston. The first is his amazing ability to carry the gospel of dispute resolution 24 hours, 7 days a week. He truly walked his talk wherever he went. Brian believed that relationships matter, that compromise is generally possible, that discussion is always honorable, that talking helps, that listening helps more, that shared values can and should be found, that conflict resolution should benefit the parties, not the mediator or the politician, that every conflict is part of a bigger picture, and everyone's story is worth hearing. One of the things I liked best about Brian is that he was extremely versatile. He was certainly comfortable with just about anyone, and he could make anyone feel comfortable. He worked well in a very wide array of environments with a broad cross-section of people. He was a teacher, an administrator, a legislator, a mediator, and of course, a really good friend. You could call on Brian to do any job, and you could trust that he could do it. And then lastly, one of my favorite things about Brian was his self-deprecating sense of humor. And I just loved how he went through life making fun of himself, an old, I think he said middle-aged, balding, fat white guy. And I just really appreciated that about him. Someone with such incredible intelligence, someone with incredible skills, always made other people feel at ease with his sense of humor. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you, Tobias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tobias Reed. I'm honored to be state representative from District 27 in Beaverton, in no small part because of Representative Johnston. I had the honor to work for him in a variety of contexts, both here in the legislature, across the street at Willamette, and in other spots. And I think perhaps that's one aspect of his contributions that hasn't been mentioned as much so far, but the fact that I'm here, the fact that two of his kids are here, his dedication to public service is legendary. And I had the most difficult task of my legislative career a few weeks ago when I carried this resolution on the floor of the House, and the challenge of trying to capture who he was in so many different dimensions in just a few minutes was particularly challenging. I think the folks who have gone before me have done a good job of capturing so many ways that he was such a unique and special person, but I would just probably underline the thing that I try to keep in mind as I do my work here, which is to take the work seriously but not take yourself too seriously. The Secretary of State stole the line out when you asked Brian how he was. He always would answer the same way by saying chubby, bald, fun to be with. And that's something we can probably take a lesson from. In the end, I think the best way, just to sort of reiterate what I said on the floor, that I think we can honor his work is to try to live up to his standards and remember what Governor McCall said about heroes not being giant statues, and just being people who work to make our communities better. It's a tremendous legacy, and I'm proud to count him as one of my mentors. Even while he's not here, I use that as what would Brian do as a real test. So I appreciate your consideration of the resolution, and certainly urge your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All
Thank you.
And Drew.
Mr. Chair.
For the record, my name is Drew Johnston, son of Brian Johnston. I want to thank you guys for the time to hear this resolution and for everyone who's come to speak. We did this on the House side, and that was interesting, but I'm very pleased to do it with my sister over there, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing and the honor. You know, we're proud to, you know, take his legacy and live it on, and my family does thank you for considering the motion. So thank you, guys.
Well, thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 8C or 5 or 3? Not.
Yes.
Michelle, please.
And members of the committee, I will be very brief, and Courtney doesn't know I'm going to do this because I just decided. I'm here today as Ron L. Schenkel, citizen, not member of Department of Justice. I live in West Salem in Polk County, and Brian Johnston was the first legislator that I was ever aware of as a legislator. When my son was born in 1992, he has BREC, he has developmental disabilities, and he was the first child mainstreamed into a particular school here in Salem, a preschool, when he was 2 and a half, and I still remember and have a picture to this day of when Brian took the time out from his busy schedule to come and meet me and meet Breck. And he was such an inspiration that he's part of the reason you all get to live with me for the past 10 years and got me interested in this line of work. So I just wanted to honor him also today and say thank you.
Well, thank you. Any questions? All right, I'm going to close our hearing, but before I do,
I was going to make a comment, so I don't.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know Brian Johnston well. I met him a couple of times through Drew when we were sharing an office in the district, and was able to attend his memorial ceremony. And I think what we're going to see is what we heard here is I think that his legacy is going to live on. And I keep hearing about all these people who had either been inspired by Brian Johnston or their lives have been changed by him. And I think we're going to continue to see that for a long time. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this.
Well, thank you. That's actually a nice segue for myself. Brian and I, and there are 21 of us that started as freshmen in 1995. And five of us were considered very good friends, the five Omegles. And so we did a lot of things in and outside of the Capitol. And I always was honored to be part of the group, and having Brian as a mentor and as a colleague, an individual that actually practiced what he preached, and was not bashful to tell you where he may have some differences, but in a very mediating way. And with that, I'm very pleased that we have taken this opportunity to recognize one of our own, someone that has actually given such public service to the community, to the state, and that then just looking, as you said, the legacies that are coming out of it from just the family alone, not to mention those who have had the opportunity to be public servants, maybe not in the elected arena, but throughout their communities. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on HCR 3 and open a work session on HCR 3.
Mr. Chair, move HCR 3 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House concurrent resolution 3, HCR 3, to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry this one. And we'll close the work session on HCR 3, and thank you for those who came forward. And our last bill that we have for today is going to be open up a public hearing on House Bill 2336. And, Council, you want to give us an overview?
House Bill 2336 allows for convictions under another jurisdiction's statutory counterpart to be entered into evidence in certain criminal proceedings. It has no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right. And Rob, I think you're here. And then I think Gail was also going to be testifying. Let both of you come up, please.
The
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovette, Lincoln County District Attorney. House Bill 2336 is a technical correction to a statute in the evidence code. Currently under Oregon law, we are allowed to impeach the credibility of a witness in certain cases for prior criminal convictions, and you'll see in the statute it's set forth. This bill proposes to allow the impeachment of those witnesses, same witnesses, for convictions for the statutory counterpart of those exact crimes in other jurisdictions. As you've heard over the past few sessions, we've added statutory counterpart language to a variety of statutes, such as DUI and diversion. And this is this bill is proposed to do the same for this particular evidence code provision. This bill was heard in the House side. It was on consent calendar. It received no opposition on the House side. I believe it passed 52-0. I will also let you know that, as was testified on the House side, there are a number of judges, in fact, I believe a majority of judges in Oregon, that actually interpret this statute to actually include the statutory counterparts. So what this bill would largely do is create uniformity across the state for impeachment purposes. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. First, we'll take testimony from Gail.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Bovette's correct. There was no opposition on the House side because I missed the hearing. I came through the door at 2 minutes after one, and the gavel was going down, and we're closing the hearing on House Bill 2336. So I did inform the District Attorney's Association. I did have comments on this side. With respect to this bill, OCDLA is a general rule whenever legislation is passed incorporating crimes or statutes from other states, would prefer that there be an explicit requirement of element matching. And sometimes that's done by the legislature, and sometimes it is not done. And when it is done, it's done expressly. So if the elements would constitute the same offense here in Oregon, something of that nature. By using the phraseology statutory counterpart in another jurisdiction, that language, statutory counterpart, is interpreted quite broadly. What it basically means is either the statutes need to be either remarkably similar or have the same use, role, or characteristics. Now, if I might, I'd like to narrow my comments down to the incorporation of the menacing and the harassment charges. I think as to the assaults and the strangulation, it's easy to infer when there's a statutory counterpart. With respect to our harassment statute here in Oregon, it's really broad and some would even suggest quite vague. It's got a lot of multiple different counterparts to it. And I would suggest that might be a difficult statute for anyone to know if there really were a statutory counterpart in some other jurisdiction. So our harassment statute picks up conduct that where the defendant intentionally harasses or annoys another person, subjects another person to offensive physical contact, publicly insults another person by abusive words or gestures, subjects another to alarm by conveyance of assault, false report, knowing it to be false, concerning death or serious physical injury, subjects another to alarm by conveying a telephonic or electronic written threat. It kind of goes on. And so there's a lot of subparts of our harassment statute. I would suggest that at a bare minimum, we would ask the committee to delete harassment from this provision, because I think it would be very difficult, given the language of our harassment statute, for a judge to realistically know if there's a statutory counterpart in some other jurisdiction.
All right. Questions? Comments? I think that's it. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on the House Bill 2336? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2336. And I'm going to go ahead and hold this over for, I want to review one part of it before I'm ready to move forward, but we'll schedule this. Let's see, today is Wednesday. Yeah.
What the chair is going to do is we're going to carry this bill forward till tomorrow, and so we're going to continue our public hearing and work session for House Bill 2336 until tomorrow, which is Thursday. I believe that is the 12th of March. And so that's the order on that. And then, Council, I think we've got everything else taken care of.
That's correct.
All right. So those who are interested in House Bill 2336 know that it's scheduled for continuation for tomorrow during our regular scheduled time starting at 8:30. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the committee for today, and we'll proceed tomorrow at 8:30.